From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I didn't know that something happened until I came to the living room and you were upset. You said there was something wrong with Pop-Up that made me scared. Remember that Mikey told me that planes crashed and he wasn't coming back.
Today, on the 7th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, we bring you the voices of 9/11. Part of the Oral History Project StoryCorps September 11th initiative. We'll be joined by radio pioneer and StoryCorps founder Dave Isay, as well as Noreen Schneider, who lost her brother at the World Trade Center. And we'll talk with Terry Rockefeller, a member of the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Her sister Laura died at the Twin Towers. She's just back from Iraq. And we'll go back to our archive, the day two 9/11 victims met in our studio. Rita Lazar, who lost her brother, Abe Zalmanowitz, and Masuda Sultan, an Afghan New Yorker who lost 19 members of her family when the U.S. bombed Afghanistan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The New York Times is reporting President Bush has secretly approved U.S. ground attacks in Pakistan without the Pakistani government's prior approval. The order came in July, less than 2 months before last week's deadly assault that killed some 20 civilians. In what would have been the first attack under the new policy, U.S. forces are said to have fired inside three homes containing women and children. On Wednesday, Pakistan's top military chief harshly criticized the U.S. ground attack, saying Pakistan will defend its sovereignty, quote, at all costs. The military chief, General Ashfaq Parvez Kayani, said no external army is allowed to conduct operations inside Pakistan. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has admitted he doesn't believe the U.S. military is winning its fight against insurgents in Afghanistan. General Mike Mullen testified Wednesday before the House Armed Services Committee.
I'm not convinced we're winning it in Afghanistan. I am convinced we can. That is why I intend to commission and looking at a new, more comprehensive military strategy for the region that covers both sides of that border.
General Mullen's comments come one day after President Bush announced an increase to the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan by around 5,000 troops. Mullen said the additional troops mark a good start, but a larger number is needed down the line, he said. The Iraqi government's withdrawn a plan to award 6 no-bid contracts to large Western oil companies. Earlier this summer, Iraq announced it would let ExxonMobil, Shell, Total, BP, and Chevron service Iraq's largest oil fields. But Iraqi officials say the agreements have taken too long to complete. The companies will still be eligible to bid on open deals. In Haiti, recovery efforts continue in the aftermath of the latest devastating tropical storm. Haiti's third largest city, Gonaïves, remains mostly underwater. Food and fresh water supplies are said to be running low for tens of thousands of people living on top of their rooftops, in the streets or emergency shelters. The United Nations has launched a $100 million appeal for emergency humanitarian aid. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Dana Perino announced the Bush administration would commit just $10 million, half of it already pledged.
Finally, the United States government will dedicate $10 million to immediate disaster assistance to Haiti following Hurricane Gustav, Hanna, and Ike. Of this amount, $5 million is new funding pledged or programmed in the past week. Our support includes provision of relief, supplies, transportation, and logistics to deliver relief and ongoing damage assessments. Our highest priority is to help deliver urgently needed relief supplies to communities which are now cut off from overland access.
As many as 1,000 Haitians have died and nearly a million displaced in 4 major storms and hurricanes in less than a month. In Bolivia, President Evo Morales says he's asked the U.S. ambassador to return to Washington. Speaking at the presidential palace, Morales said Ambassador Philip Goldberg has helped orchestrate efforts by oil-rich provinces to declare autonomy.
Without fear of the empire, and before all of you and the people of Bolivia, I declare U.S. Ambassador Goldberg persona non grata.
Persona non grata. Morales has frequently accused the U.S. of siding with his right-wing opponents. The State Department says it hasn't received a formal request for Goldberg's departure. Here in the United States, an internal probe has uncovered a major bribery, sex, and drug abuse scandal at the Department of Interior. Government officials were found to have collected lavish gifts from the oil companies they were supposed to be regulating. Some officials engaged in sex and drug use with oil industry executives. Inspector General Earl Devaney says the Bush administration-era Interior Department has had, quote, a culture of ethical failure. From 2002 to 2006, one-third of 55 staffers at the Denver Office of the Mineral Management Service accepted bribes from oil companies. The companies involved include Chevron, Shell, and Hess. Former MMS Associate Director Lucy Dennett was the highest-ranking official to be accused. Investigators found she worked with two aides to steer a lucrative contract to one of the aides after he retired. Another MMS supervisor was found to have increased an employee's performance award for selling him cocaine. The MMS is responsible for collecting royalties from oil companies that operate on federal and native lands. The disclosures come as Congress prepares to consider Republican proposals to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for private drilling. And today is the 7th anniversary of 9/11. Presidential nominees Barack Obama and John McCain have agreed to scale back campaigning today and will appear together at a Ground Zero ceremony honoring the nearly 3,000 people killed in the attacks. The latest row between the two campaigns has McCain's camp accusing Obama of sexism. The dispute centers over Obama's use of the colloquialism lipstick on a pig when talking about McCain's vow to bring change to Washington despite supporting President Bush's key policies.
But, you know, you can't, you know, you can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig.
Let's start with track one, if Maureen
isn't
here.
The McCain campaign says Obama was in fact referring to Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin. Obama has dismissed the allegation and says the McCain campaign is manufacturing a phony controversy over a common saying. McCain himself has used the term several times, including in 2002.
I think they put some lipstick on the pig, but it's still a pig.
In Minnesota, a local estimate says some 40 journalists were arrested or detained during last week's Republican National Convention in St. Paul. The Minnesota Independent has published a list that includes Associated Press reporters, an AP photographer, a St. Paul Pioneer Press photographer, a New York Post freelance photographer, independent journalists, college journalists, and three of us at Democracy Now!, myself and producer Sharif Abdokadous and Nicole Salazar. Libertarian presidential nominee Bob Barr has asked Republican Congressmember Ron Paul to join his ticket as his vice presidential nominee. Paul made a failed bid for the Republican nomination earlier this year. Barr's request came as he refused to appear at a unity event with other third-party candidates in Washington, D.C. Barr initially pledged to attend, but backed out after citing differences with Green Party candidate Cynthia McKinney. McKinney and Paul appeared at the event Wednesday, along with independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader and Constitution Party nominee Chuck Baldwin. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich has presented House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with another petition for the impeachment of President Bush. The latest petition has about 50,000 signatures on top of the 100,000 already submitted. Kucinich is calling for establishing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to order testimony and gather documents on why the Bush administration chose to invade Iraq. And in California, four people have ended their nearly two-year sit-in atop several redwood trees in Berkeley. The protesters have been living in a grove on the University of California, Berkeley campus since late 2006 in an effort to save the trees from being cut down to make room for a multi-million dollar sports facility. The tree sit-in came to an end after workers and police used scaffolding to arrest the protesters atop the remaining 90-foot redwood. The tree was cut down hours later. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Memorials are being held across the country today to mark the 7th anniversary of the 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon that killed nearly 3,000 people. In Washington, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are attending a dedication of the 9/11 Pentagon Memorial. Here in New York, presidential candidates Barack Obama and John McCain will meet and lay a wreath together at Ground Zero. Tonight, Obama and McCain will speak at Columbia University in a nationally televised forum about civic engagement and service.
We begin our coverage of the 9/11 anniversary by playing audio recordings from the StoryCorps September 11th initiative. For the past 3 years, the Oral History Project StoryCorps has recorded nearly 800 interviews from relatives and friends of people killed on September 11th. These recordings will eventually be preserved as part of the National September 11th Memorial Museum's permanent collection. The founder of StoryCorps, Dave Isay, joins us here in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dave.
Hi, Amy.
Talk about StoryCorps in general for those who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. StoryCorps is a very simple idea. We opened 5 years ago, and we built a booth in Grand Central Terminal where you bring a loved one, a parent or a friend or even your bus driver to do an interview about their lives. You sit in this booth, the lights are low for 40 minutes, and you look each other in the eyes and ask about one another's lives and tell someone how much you love them by listening to them. At the end of 40 minutes, two CDs are burned. One goes home with you, the other goes to the Library of Congress to become part of this oral history of America. And the idea of StoryCorps, there are kind of many underpinning kind of ideas of StoryCorps. One of the ideas is that our stories, the stories of regular people, are as interesting and as important, if not more interesting and more important than the kind of celebrity nonsense we're bombarded from all everywhere we look 24 hours a day. And the idea that people want to know that they matter and that they won't be forgotten. When StoryCorps started, I had a feeling that we'd see a lot of people come in who had a loved one who was very ill to record their stories, and we did see that. But we also saw something I didn't expect, which was families coming in to remember a loved one who had passed away and memorialize them in that way. So when the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation asked us to open a booth down at the World Trade Center site, it made a lot of sense. And we opened a booth for families to come in and remember loved ones who were lost on September 11th, and also for rescue workers and survivors to come in and tell their stories.
Why don't you introduce us to the first clip?
Sure. I think what I'm going to play first is actually clip number one, which is Chief William Feehan. And this was actually from before StoryCorps. This is one of the inspirations for StoryCorps. William Feehan died at 71. He was the oldest and highest-ranking firefighter to die on September 11th. And he had done, he had been interviewed by his son a couple of years before his death. And Bill Feehan, his son, is a friend of mine and gave me this tape on September 11th. And we put together this tape along with Chief Feehan's favorite music for his memorial service. So this was kind of one of the inspirations before StoryCorps started. On September 11th, this was put together. It's Chief Feehan. His father, Chief Feehan's father, was a firefighter. Chief Feehan's son, John, is a firefighter. And these are Chief Feehan's own words talking about being a firefighter put to his favorite music. And that's clip one.
When you have a department whose men and women are expected to be ready at any moment to put their life on the line, to go to the aid of a stranger, even when it means that you may put yourself in dire peril, I don't think you can pay people to do that job. There has to be something beyond money that makes them do that. The whole department exists for one reason. The whole department exists simply to serve the people of the city. And I know that everybody hears those kinds of things, and it sounds kind of corny, it sounds a little hackneyed perhaps, but that's the reason this department exists. And the thing that sets the firefighter apart is that it's he or she who, when the bell sounds, has to go and be ready at any moment to go in harm's way and to do whatever is necessary to help the person who called them. This department is rich in tradition. It's rich in history. You know, we've had 127 years of paid fire department in New York City. And in that 127 years, we've lost 752 people. That's an awfully large number. And I don't think anybody who understands this business and understands this department, I mean, I think we all have the same wish that that's the last, that we'll never lose another. But I know as soon as I'm sitting here that no matter what we do, no matter how well we train, No matter how good our equipment is, no matter how hard we try, no matter what, they'll be at 753rd.
Bill Feehan made this recording of his dad, William Feehan, of course, before September 11th, when William Feehan died. Juan?
Dave, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the process of collecting the interviews, these were all people who came to your booth. You didn't go out and try to find them to do the interviews? Or?
Yes, people come to our, we made an announcement 3 years ago that we were opening this booth, and then 2 years ago that we were going to try and collect one story for every life lost, and it's 2,981 lives lost, at least one story for each life lost. So family members know about us, and when we're a human service. It's very difficult to come into this booth and make these recordings. When families are ready, they come in by themselves or with a loved one. We've done 20,000 StoryCorps interviews in total across the country. And most people come in pairs. We actually found that a lot of September 11th families come in by themselves. And when they come in by themselves, they're interviewed by a facilitator, someone who works with us. So families come to us and make a recording about their loved one who passed away.
I wanted to go to a clip you have of Noreen Schneider talking about her brother, and then we'll be joined by Noreen Schneider live.
Yeah, Noreen and her mom, Arlene, were the first people to record in our booth down at Ground Zero. And they came to remember Tommy, who was Noreen's brother, who perished at Windows on the World on September 11th.
This is the clip.
He was always very smart, very bright boy. When he was five, we went into a candy store one day, and the man had a sign, pretzels, 2 cents each, or 2 for 5 cents. And he said to the man, "That sign's not right, mister." He said, "It's 2 cents each or 3 for 5 cents." So the man said, "My sign's not wrong." And Tommy said, "Well, then I want 1 for 2 cents and another 1 for 2 cents. He didn't want to give him that extra penny. So maybe he was cut out for finance even at that age.
Noreen Schneider, her brother Tommy Sullivan killed at the World Trade Center on September 11th. Where was he, Noreen? And welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, and thank you for having me. Tommy was having breakfast at a meeting at Windows on the World.
He worked there?
No, he worked on the New York Stock Exchange.
There were, it was a breakfast of some 500 people. I've met a lot of the workers at Windows on the World who survived, those who maybe were scheduled that morning to work, but then got pushed over to the afternoon. A number of them set up a new restaurant called Colors, a worker-owned collective where they come back together. But tell us about that. Morning.
Well, every Tuesday, he was a floor broker on the New York Stock Exchange, and every Tuesday they had a meeting to meet with the American Stock Exchange brokers just to talk about the business. So it was just their regular, Tuesday morning. The funny thing is that Tommy was supposed to have surgery the week before, but he didn't want to miss that meeting, so he made sure that he went in, for it. He was having surgery the next day.
And your decision to participate in the StoryCorps interviews, how did you feel about that, about sort of bearing what you knew about your brother and his stories?
I think one of the things that I looked for when all this began was the best way to have him remembered. You know, the thing that bothered me the most was that people didn't know who he was as a person, so when I met Dave and he talked about the project, I fell in love with it because I said, this is the best way for people to know him the way that I do. And who better to tell his story than me?
Where were you, Noreen, that morning?
I was home. I called in sick, only because I worked across the street, so I wasn't there. I wound up there later on during the day, but I worked at 200 Liberty, which is right across from the World Trade Center.
And you just happened to be sick that day?
Just happened to be sick that day.
And when did you learn about what happened to Tommy?
I watched it on TV, and I knew that he was at that meeting. So I hopped into my car, and I just hoped, because their meeting normally ended at 8:30. So in my head, he was already down, already on the street, and I was just going to go and get him. So I drove down to Jersey City to try to, get as close as I could to him.
And the bonds that developed among the families of the victims over time, have you stayed in touch with over these last 7 years with some of the other families?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't understand the way that we feel, so that we have our own little family now. Yes, I'm very good friends with some of the other sisters because they get, you know, the way that I feel. And my mother's friendly with some of the mothers, and we formed our own little group, you know, of people that get along.
What will you be doing today to honor this day?
We're going to go to the site after this, and then we're having a ceremony for him later on tonight.
We at Democracy Now! Are just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. In fact, we were broadcasting Democracy Now! When the second tower was hit. The first tower hit at 8:46. It was right before we used to record Democracy Now! At 9. The second plane hit about 9:02. We had just begun the broadcast. We, ironically, were doing a special that day on another September 11th and its connection with terrorism, September 11th, 1973, when Salvador Allende died in the palace in Chile as the Pinochet forces rose to power. And then everything outside overwhelmed what we were doing. Well, a year later, on September 11th, 2002, we had a many-hour broadcast in our studio here at DCTV, where we broadcast from, Downtown Community Television, a 100-year-old firehouse, which, by the way, on September 11th, 2001, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno, who run this community media center, opened the doors to help people who were running from the World Trade Center, getting them water, allowing them to use the phones. But a year later, lots of people came to our studio, and one of the people offered this song. She was Odetta.
When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call. Hold my hand, lest I fall. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me home.
Precious Lord, take my hand. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On this very solemn day, on September 11th, 7 years ago, the planes hit both towers of the World Trade Center and took them down. Almost 3,000 people died. Dave Isay, our guest, radio pioneer, founder of StoryCorps, with a special project, the September 11th Initiative. Continue on the journey, Dave.
Sure. We're going to play a clip now of Monique Ferrer, who came into StoryCorps to remember her ex-husband, Michael Trinidad. Michael was worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. He was a telecommunications specialist. And this is Monique remembering her ex-husband.
I met Michael at a Halloween party. I was 14 and he was 16 years old. And when I saw him, I knew that he was going to be my boyfriend. And we got married when I was 19. And we were both kids. We really didn't know what next, you know, party, get married, and, you know, now what? When we were divorced, I remember the kids telling me that their father confided in them with a secret, and they didn't want to tell me. And I'm like, well, what's the secret? And they said, well, Daddy still loves you. He doesn't want us to tell you. And I said, well, I know. I've always known, and I love him too. But Mommy and Daddy are gone their separate ways, but we'll always be a family, and we'll always be your mom and dad. On 9/11, I remember getting up to take my daughter. She had a doctor's appointment, so my daughter was home. At 9:04, I got a phone call, and it was Michael. And he was calling from the 103rd floor. And the first thing that he said was, I'm calling to say goodbye. And I said, why? Where are you going? And he said, well, I'm in the building that was just hit by a plane. He just wanted to tell me how much he loved the children. And he says, you know, I also want to tell you that I always loved you. And I said, I know. The kids told me. And I'm remarried, so my husband was next to me, and I asked my husband to get on the phone, and I thought maybe my husband could talk him into finding an exit. And when my husband got on the phone, he asked my husband if he would be my children's father. And my husband said, you're going to be coming home. You're going to be their dad, and I'm their dad too. And he's like, I don't think I'm going to make it. And my daughter was there, and she saw me becoming a little hysterical, and I didn't know whether to put her on or not because I didn't know how he would react. He thought she was at school. You know, even though we weren't together anymore, it just really breaks my heart that he's not here for them. And as much as he used to drive me crazy, he was my family and my best friend.
Monique Ferrer, remembering her husband, Michael Trinidad, who died on September 11, 2001. He worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. They lost hundreds of workers, close to, was it 900 workers at the World Trade Center on that day. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Juan?
Well, Dave, you have about 800 of these interviews of family members, and you're hoping to get all 3,000 of the victims, some family member or other, to talk. Can you tell us about the next interview we're going to hear?
Sure. This is part of what I, as Noreen said, part of what's important about StoryCorps of Families is that it gives people a chance to remember who their loved one was, not on September 11th as a child or as a brother or as a boyfriend. And this is Richard Pecorella, Richie Pecorella, who was engaged to Karen Sue Jude. Karen worked as a secretary at Cantor Fitzgerald, and he came in to talk about their really incredible love affair. And he starts his story at a NASCAR race where they met each other in Pennsylvania.
A friend of mine gave me tickets to a car race. He says, why don't you go to an Indy car race? He says, get out of New York for a while. Just go have a good time. You'll enjoy the race. I went to the race and, you know, sat down, and I'm looking around, and all of a sudden Karen comes in. Blonde, curly hair, big smile on, sits down next to me and she says, hello. I said, how you doing? It's the first car race. You've never been to one? I said, nope. She said, oh, I'll tell you all about it. I knew as soon as I looked at her that she was the one. It was magical. I can't describe it. I couldn't tell her that, but I was like a 15-year-old again. I got all Google-eyed and didn't know what to do or say, and stumbling wasn't like me at all. Wasn't the typical macho Italian guy from Brooklyn. I said, maybe you'd like to go to dinner after the race. She looks at me, she goes, you know what? Maybe I will. When I met Karen, somehow she relaxed me. And she showed me how to live in a city of stress without the stress. She just taught me patience. I had very little patience. Basically, I was, you know, one of those guys rolled down the window and screamed at the drivers when they weren't driving the way I thought they should be. And she toned me down. She showed me to be nicer to people. Give it a second thought before you start yelling. And I've carried that with me. Anytime we did a driving trip, it was always an adventure, even a short trip. We would go to her brother's house quite often, and it became a joke later on. We would get frisky in the car and decide to stop at a motel along the way. And her brother would be waiting for us to get there in 2 hours, and we wouldn't get there for 5 hours. But our best trips were to Las Vegas. She loved it there, and I loved it there. We just got back from there 2 days before she was killed, and we were going to get married there the following June. Other than her going to work, there wasn't a time we weren't together. Every morning, Karen would drive with me to my office, and then she'd take the subway from my office one stop to the Trade Center. I worked in Brooklyn, so my window across the East River, I could see the Twin Towers. So I'm doing some work, and one of my workers comes in and says, Richie, I just heard that the Trade Center got hit with a plane. I turn around, and I see the building burning. And I took my office chair, and I threw it at my window. You know, I'm going into shock, I would imagine. So they brought the nurse up. The nurse says, sit down. She gives me a bottle of water. I have the bottle of water, and it's in my hand, and my hand is trembling so much that it's splashing all over me. I couldn't even hold the bottle in my hand. I miss her eyes. Her eyes sparkled to me. One day they were blue, next day they were green, depending on how the light hit them. Karen, I'll always be in love with you, and I will see you again. I will do enough good to make it up there.
Richard Peccarella remembering his fiancée, Karen Judé, as we turn now to 10-year-old Frankie DeVito remembering his grandfather, Bill Steckman.
We used to play Peter Pan, and we used to use the screwdrivers as swords and pretend I was like Peter Pan and he was Captain Hook. He always used to be in the garage fixing up things with cousin Mikey, and he also promised me he'd take me to his work once, but that's not going to happen.
I know you were young when it happened. You were only in kindergarten. Is there a time that you were the most scared when all that was going on?
I didn't know that something happened until I came into the living room and you were upset. You said there was something wrong with Pop-Up. That made me scared. Remember that Mikey told me that planes crashed and he wasn't coming back.
Is there anything you did that made you feel better to go to sleep at night?
Going up to Grandma or my parents, giving them a hug, resting on their shoulder. And sometimes when I'm in my room, I pretended that Grandpa was right there, nothing was wrong, and my teddy was right there. So that helps me.
Do you think you're different now than you were before we lost Papa?
Yeah, I think I'm different because being in certain places when I'm at a happy time, just somewhere in my mind, he just won't get out of there. He's just stuck in my mind, and that makes me a little sadder where I am. And I have dreams with him. I always imagine us, like, seeing each other again and being really happy as a family without being sad or anything on September 11th.
If you could talk to him right now, what would you want to say?
I love you, and there's no other grandfather I'd rather see than you.
Dave, tell us about 10-year-old Frankie DeVito, who we just listened to.
Well, his grandfather worked for NBC and was working the night shift and was in charge of the communications tower on top of the World Trade Center, and he came with his mom to do that interview.
10 years old.
I think he was seven when he did that interview.
Hmm. Our last clip.
This is John Vigiano, Sr., who came to StoryCorps with his wife, Jan, to remember their sons, John Jr., who was a firefighter, and Joe, who was a policeman, both of whom perished on September 11th.
There were a couple of days each year you were allowed to take your children to work, and Joe loved it. That was his birthday present, that he would come and spend the night in the firehouse. We'd have a cake, and the guys I work with, they would take a milk container and they'd cut out the facsimile of a building and they'd put it on the top of the cake and then they would light it up and they would tell Joe to put it out and he would throw a pot of water on it. The birthday cake was a little soggy, but this is what he wanted. Joe started dating a young lady whose father was a police officer, and he come home one day and he says, I'm taking a police test. I says, Joe, you're only 17 years old. But he passed the test and When he graduated, they assigned him to Brooklyn South, where I started my career. On the other side of the room, my son John wanted nothing to do with police or fire department. He wanted to be the next Donald Trump. He was going to make $1 million and take care of his mother and father. But in 1984, I came down with throat cancer. He noticed then how the New York City Fire Department, specifically my unit, they took care of us. And he says, I'm going to become a fireman. I says, you're kidding me. Firemen don't make millions of dollars. How am I going to live like a king? But I was very happy, very proud. My father had been on the fire department, and he was the first one to be issued badge number 3436. And when John decided he wanted to be a firefighter, they reissued it to my son John. So the badge was only used by two. Both the boys would call me when they were working, talk for a few minutes, and I'd say, all right, be careful, I love you. John would always call around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And that particular night, September 10th, I says, look out for your brother tonight. And he says, okay, I love you. I says, I love you. Joe called me in the morning and told me to turn on the television that a plane just hit the Trade Center. He says, I'm heading south on West Street. This is a big one. And I just said, you know, be careful. I love you. He said, I love you too. That was it. We had the boys for John for 36 years, Joe for 34 years, ironically. Badge number 3436. I don't have any could've, should've, or would've's. I wouldn't have changed anything. There's not many people that the last words they said to their son or daughter was, I love you. And the last words they heard was, I love you. So that makes me sleep at night.
John Vigiano Sr., he lost his son, John Jr., a firefighter, and Joe, a policeman. They both died at Ground Zero. Dave, what is happening now with the project?
Well, we're continuing to collect interviews, and they're all going to go into this at both the Library of Congress and the September 11th Moreland Museum. And when that museum opens up, you'll be able to listen to these stories and look at these pictures and understand the tragedy was so enormous, you know, and I think the only way to really comprehend it is to break it down into the individual stories and individual lives. And, you know, there were 3,000 human beings lost, 3,000 lives lost, and we want to do our best to remember all those lives. And that's, you know, one of the, we talked earlier about the idea of the underpinning ideas of StoryCorps, and one of the underpinning ideas is that every life matters. And that's what we're trying to do with this. You know, I think that I was thinking on the way over here about September 11th. I was also downtown just a couple of blocks away from here. And we in New York, I don't know what it was like elsewhere in the country, but something did, as we, you know, it's been talked about before, but something changed here in New York just for a couple of weeks. And it was almost a state of grace where people didn't fear each other anymore. And I think that with StoryCorps, if which I think is born out of love instead of out of hate, which is what obviously the destruction of the World Trade Center was born out of. If we, through StoryCorps and through listening and through Democracy Now and really having real conversations and really respecting each other and recognizing that every life matters, if we can just nudge the dial just a little bit towards that state of grace that we were in after 9/11, it will be in better shape as a nation.
And for those who want to be able to reach StoryCorps or...
Our website is StoryCorps.net, and you can listen to 9/11 stories and many, many other stories from StoryCorps that we've collected all over the country. And we're just, you know, we're just getting started. We've done our first 20,000 stories. We're hitting our fifth year anniversary. But, you know, we're going to grow this into a national institution that documents and defines who we are as a nation, and we want this to be accessible to everybody who wants to participate. So, again, we can look... people who are important in our lives in the eyes, people who work hard, people who live lives of courage and kindness, which is really who we are as Americans, and honor them by listening to them.
Well, Dave Isay, thanks so much for being with us, for doing this project, for documenting people's lives, which make them live on. And congratulations on the new little life in your family.
Thank you, Amy.
Welcome to the world, Izzy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, a member of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Terry Rockefeller, will join us to talk about her sister who died in the World Trade Center and her trip to Iraq. She just got back. Stay with us. Alice Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 700 stations, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, for people to read and transcript form at democracynow.org and radio stations to take to broadcast. In fact, we began on television, expanding from radio 7 years ago this week, right at the time of the September 11th attacks. We did our first TV broadcast with Manhattan Neighborhood Network, public access TV here in Manhattan. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, nearly 7 years ago, a group of family members of those killed on September 11th united to advocate for nonviolent response to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The group called themselves September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. For the past 7 years, members of the organization have traveled to Iraq, Afghanistan, and other conflict areas to meet with the victims of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror.
Our next guest, Terry Rockefeller, has just returned from her second trip to Iraq, where she met members of a new Iraqi peace group. It's called La Onf, which in Arabic translates to no violence. Terry's sister, Laura, died on September 11th. She was at Windows on the World, the restaurant.
Yes, my sister was an actress, but she had a two-day part-time job helping to run a seminar on information technology. So I really had no idea that she could possibly have been involved in the attacks. I was shocked, like everyone in the country was shocked, and it wasn't until the end of the day, 7 years ago, that I learned that she had been there. And I think that just the sheer improbable nature of her death made me think and begin to appreciate the nature of random violence and the nature of war, and understanding that so many people who live in violent situations day in and day out, not as we do here in America, but as is true in so many other parts of the world, are innocent civilians. And Peaceful Tomorrows as a group has tried to establish citizen-to-citizen connections and learn facts on the ground that I think really challenge the policies that our government has pursued.
And how soon after of the events of September 11th did you start getting involved in that movement?
I actually heard about the trip that four of the founding members of Peaceful Tomorrows made to Afghanistan, which was in January of 2002. And when I read about that on the internet, I knew I would have to get in touch with them. So, you know, the feelings were there from the beginning, just the deep fear that this violence could spread out of control, cycle out of control, and that real responses of nonviolence were called for. And when I heard about Rita and Kelly and Daryl and Ava going to Afghanistan, I knew they were people I had to meet.
I wanted to ask you, because I remember that back in early 2003, there was a CNN interview with you as you were getting ready to go to Iraq before the U.S.
Yes.
invasion.
Yeah.
And Miles O'Brien, the person who interviewed you from CNN, kept saying that you were being naive, or weren't you actually helping to prop up the propaganda machine of Saddam Hussein? And looking back, remembering that interview now and all the things that have happened since then, the same CNN now that is constantly, their announcers constantly berating what's going on in Iraq?
Yeah, naive, unpatriotic, we were called a lot of things. But I do believe that those of us who were personally affected by the 9/11 violence understood something viscerally about the nature of terrorism, which is that it feeds on itself. And you can take steps to break the cycles. And I think that continues to be a message that our administration and the entire American public needs to hear.
I just want to note, as we record this broadcast, stations will run it at different times through the day. This is the moment at 8:46 when the first plane hit the first tower of the World Trade Center. There's silence through New York right now. The feelings of Iraqis when they hear that you, Terry, lost your sister on September 11th.
Well, when I was in Iraq just a little over a week ago now, I was attending this meeting of a a two-year-old now, but really rapidly growing network of peace and nonviolence activists in Iraq. I think that the first response to our telling our stories, and I was accompanied by another Peaceful Tomorrows member, Adele Welty, whose son was a firefighter and also died in the Trade Center, was that they found our choice of pursuing nonviolence surprising and improbable. But then I think it made a very, very deep bond. You know, literally every member of this organization had a comparable story to tell us of losing a family member. And yet they have chosen in their cities and in within their society to reach out to support dialogue rather than violence, to try to prevent the use of toy guns, which have been leading children in Iraq to be shot out by the military. They are working to build a culture of peace, and they're doing it with the deep knowledge of their own society. So I found that by the end of spending a week with them, we had built bonds of hope. And I, as a member of Peaceful Tomorrows, I will be working to see that as their week of nonviolence happens soon, we can spread more word about their achievements.
Well, Terry Rockefeller, you mentioned Rita. You were referring to Rita Lazar. Mm-hmm. She was 70 years old when she lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. And as you pointed out, she then went to Afghanistan. Yes. She had written to President Bush, begged him not to attack, said, "Not in my name." And we had a remarkable moment with her and an Afghan New Yorker in our studio meeting. And this is what we're going to go to first. First, the Afghan New Yorker. We're turning now to Afghanistan and what happened when the U.S. bombs began to fall on that country just a month after the events of September 11, 2001. We spoke to Afghan New Yorker Masuda Sultan. She lost 19 members of her family while they were taking refuge in a farmhouse trying to escape the bombs. She joined us on the phone from Afghanistan in January of 2002.
One evening at about midnight, while they were sleeping, they heard some loud noises outside and realized that their area was being bombed. Some rockets hit nearby, and they decided they had to leave their rooms as they were running outside of their rooms. Some of them were wounded by rockets. Some of them were being shot at. They described the scene where they were running with their kit in their arms, dodging bullets left and right while they had, well, they saw balls of fire falling down to the earth. They had no idea what was going on, and they were just running in any which direction for their lives. Some of them hid under an area that was covered, and some of them heard word of their loved ones falling to the ground as they were
We're talking to Masuda Sultan, who's describing how her family members were killed by the U.S. bombs that fell on the farmhouse they were taking refuge in outside of Kandahar. She's speaking to us from Afghanistan.
There were some women and children running for their lives, being shot at by a helicopter hovering over their homes. And these people were not Taliban supporters. They weren't al-Qaeda fighters. They were simple Afghans trying to stay safe in their own country. The events of September 11th really made me angry, but seeing these people and what they went through make me angry as well. You know, they say that in war, they say that you have to break a couple of eggs in order to make an omelet, but when those eggs are your family, what can you do?
How many members of your family were killed in the bombing?
19 members of that extended family were killed. There were many women and children in that 19, and we were shown some of the pictures as well, and we met the children that became orphans or that lost their mothers. One of them was a little girl that was a year and a half old, and she had been drinking breast milk, and they were having trouble with her getting used to the powdered milk. But it's just, when you see the faces of those little children and they tell you the story of how their mother died on their lap, with the blood flowing out of their head, and they ran, and they ran for their lives. It breaks your heart. It breaks your heart to know that this is the collateral damage of war.
That was Afghan New Yorker Masuda Sultan speaking to us from Afghanistan. When she returned in January of 2002, she came into our studio and met for the first time Rita Lazar, who lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz in the World Trade Center attacks. Together, they sat and listened to Masuda's report to us from Afghanistan. And then we spoke to them. We begin with Rita Lazar.
I was listening to the radio, and the newscaster broke in to say that a plane had hit one of the World Trade Center buildings. And I thought, gee, what an accident. And I live on the 15th floor, and ran to my neighbor's house, and she has a clear view of downtown Manhattan. And I looked out her window and saw the second plane hit the second building. And it dawned on me, my brother works there. My brother's in that building. And I sort of went crazy. And then I went about the day doing what all those other people did, calling every hospital, trying to find out if he had been brought to a hospital. I went down to the hospitals to see if his name was on the list. And then I realized he had died. And because he had stayed behind to stay with his quadriplegic brother, friend, who couldn't get out, although he was on the 27th floor and he could have saved himself, he died.
How do you know that? How do you know that
He
story?
Was on the phone with my other brother and my sister-in-law, and he said, don't worry, we're waiting for the firemen to come, and as soon as they come, they're going to help Ed and me get out of here. Ed was in a wheelchair and could not move. But by the time the firemen came, the building collapsed, and it was too late. And then President Bush mentioned him in the National Cathedral speech and cited him as being a hero. And I realized that my government was going to use my brother as justification for killing other people. And that had a tremendous impact on me. I didn't want that to happen, not in my brother's name. And so I wrote a letter to the Times, which they printed, asking our government to please be cautious and not do something they couldn't take back. And then I was asked to speak at a peace rally, and I did it. And just before I went on, I was told they had started bombing Afghanistan. And I realized something I had never realized before. I'd heard the term collateral damage all my life. It was always used about people far away from us. And I realized now what it meant, because my brother was collateral damage in a war that he didn't want and Masuda's people didn't want. And I knew I had to do something, but I didn't know what. And then I got a call from this wonderful woman from this marvelous organization called Global Exchange. And she said, would you like to go to Afghanistan and meet people like you who have lost their families? And I thought, that's perfect, because Masuda and I are the same. There's no difference between us. My family member died, I'm grieving, and her family, God, I don't know how you survive just hearing about yours. But we're the same people, and so I'm going to Afghanistan, I'm going to see the people who have been left behind while their families died, with three other people who have lost family members, either in the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, or the Pentagon, or the World Trade Center. And we're going to come back here, and we're going to try to get the American public to open its heart and its wallet for your people the way they have done for us.
Rita Lazar lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center, September 11, 2001. He could have gotten out, but he was waiting for the emergency workers to come out to help his friend Ed, who worked next to him at Blue Cross Blue Shield, who was a paraplegic. They died together with almost 3,000 other people. And that does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to hear the full conversation between Rita Lazar and Masuda Soltan, Afghan New Yorker, and Rita, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Bokadus, Aaron Mata, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen. Miguel Nogueira and Peter Curries are engineers today. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Angie Kiefer, Samantha Chambly, Jay Salnour, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Laura Chipley. I'll be today in the afternoon at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Tomorrow, head to Portland, Maine, and then on Saturday to Bangor, and Saturday night to Bar Harbor, Maine, speaking. Go to our website, democracynow.org, for schedule. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Peace.